the descendants of Ham.
Southern intellectuals found a shade of agreement with Northern white reformers who, while not agreeing on slavery, agreed on the nature of the most tragic victim of the emerging capitalism. I was formerly like yourself, sir, a very warm advocate of the abolition of slavery. The labor reformer, George Henry Evans, argued in a letter to the abolitionist, Gerrit Smith. This was before I saw that there was white slavery. Evans was a putative ally of Smith and his fellow abolitionists, but still he asserted the landless white as worse off than the enslaved blacks, who at least enjoyed surety of support in sickness and old age. The invokers of white slavery held that there was nothing unique in the enslavement of blacks when measured against the enslavement of all workers. What evil there was in enslavement resulted from its status as subsidiary to that broader exploitation better seen among the country's noble laboring whites. Once the broader problem of white exploitation was solved, the subsidiary problem of black exploitation could be confronted or perhaps even fade away. Abolitionists focused on slavery were dismissed as substitutionists, who wished to trade one form of slavery for another. If I am less troubled concerning the slavery prevalent in Charleston or New Orleans, wrote the reformer Horace Greeley, it is because I see so much slavery in New York, which appears to claim my first efforts. The Civil War destroyed the charge of substitutionism and rendered the white slavery argument ridiculous. But its operating premises, white labor as noble archetype and black labor as something else, lived on. This was a matter of rhetoric, not fact. The noble white labor archetype did not give white workers immunity from capitalism. It could not, in itself, break monopolies, alleviate white poverty in Appalachia or the South, nor bring a decent wage to immigrant ghettos in the North. But the model for America's original identity politics was set. Black lives literally did not matter, and could be cast aside altogether as the price for even incremental gains for the white masses. It was this juxtaposition that allowed Theodore Bilbo to campaign in the 1930s as someone who would raise the same kind of hell as President Franklin D. Roosevelt, and endorse lynching black people to keep them from voting. The juxtaposition between the valid and even virtuous interests of the working class and the invalid and pathological interests of black Americans was not merely the province of blatant white supremacists like Bilbo. Acclaimed scholar, liberal hero, and future senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan, in his time working for President Nixon, approvingly quoted Nixon's formulation of the white working class. A new voice was beginning to make itself felt in the country. It is a voice that has been silent too long, claimed Nixon, alluding to working class whites. It is a voice of people who have not taken to the streets before, who have not indulged in violence, who have not broken the law. Moynihan's sense of history was creationist. It had been only 18 years since the Cicero riots, 8 years since Daisy and Bill Myers had been run out of Levittown, Pennsylvania, 3 years since Martin Luther King Jr. had been stoned while walking through Chicago's Market Park. But as the myth of the virtuous white working class was made central to American identity, its sins, which were parcel to the sins of white people of every class, needed to be rendered invisible. The fact was that working class whites had been agents of racist terrorism since at least the draft riots of 1863, and that terrorism could not be neatly separated from the racist animus found in every class of whites. Indeed, in the era of lynching, it was often the daily newspaper that served to whip up the fury of the white masses by invoking the last species of property that all white men held in common, white women. But to conceal the breadth of white racism, these racist outbursts were often disregarded or treated not as racism, but as the unfortunate side effect of legitimate grievances against capital. By focusing solely on that sympathetic laboring class, the sins of whiteness itself were, and are still being, evaded. When David Duke, a former Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan, shocked the country in 1990 by almost winning the Republican primary for one of Louisiana's seats in the U.S. Senate, the apologists came out once again. They elided the obvious that Duke had appealed to the base racist instincts of a state whose schools are, at this very moment, still desegregating, and instead decided that something else was afoot. There is a tremendous amount of anger and frustration among working-class whites, particularly where there is an economic downturn, a researcher told the Los Angeles Times. These people feel left out. They feel government is not responsive to them. By this logic, post-war America, with its booming economy and low unemployment, should have been an egalitarian utopia and not the violently segregated country it actually was. But this was the past made present. It was not important to these commentators that a large swath of Louisiana's white population thought it was a good idea to send a white supremacist who once fronted a terrorist organization to the nation's capital. Nor was it important that blacks in Louisiana had long felt left out. What was important was the fraying of an ancient bargain and the potential degradation of white workers to the level of niggers. A viable left must find a way to differentiate itself strongly from such analysis, Roediger wrote. The challenge of differentiation has largely been ignored. Instead, an imagined white working class remains central to our politics and our cultural understanding of those politics, not simply when it comes to addressing broad economic issues, but also when it comes to addressing racism. At its most sympathetic, this belief holds that all Americans, regardless of race, are exploited by the structure and particulars of an unfettered capitalist economy. The key, then, is to address those broader patterns that afflict the masses of all races, and those who suffer from those patterns more than others, blacks for instance, will benefit disproportionately from that which benefits everyone. These days, what ails working class and middle class blacks and Latinos is not fundamentally different from what ails their white counterparts, wrote Senator Barack Obama in 2006. Downsizing, outsourcing, automation, wage stagnation, the dismantling of employer-based healthcare and pension plans, and schools that fail to teach young people the skills they need to compete in a global economy. Obama allowed that blacks in particular have been vulnerable to these trends, but not so much because of racism, but for reasons of geography and job sector distribution. This rendition, Raceless Anti-Racism, marks the modern left, from New Democrat Bill Clinton to Socialist Bernie Sanders. With few exceptions, there is little recognition among national liberal politicians that there is something systemic and particular in the relationship between black people and their country that might require specific policy solutions. 3. In 2016, Hillary Clinton offered more rhetorical support to the existence of systemic racism than any of her modern Democratic predecessors. She had to. Black voters well remembered the previous Clinton administration as well as her previous campaign. While her husband's administration had touted the rising tide theory, it did so while slashing welfare and getting tough on crime, a phrase that stood for specific policies, but also as rhetorical bait for white voters. One is tempted to excuse Hillary Clinton for having to answer for the sins of her husband, but in her 2008 campaign, Hillary Clinton evoked the old dichotomy between white workers and loafing blacks, claiming to be the representative of hard-working Americans, white Americans. By the end of the 2008 primary campaign against Barack Obama, her advisors were hoping someone would uncover the apocryphal Whitey tape in which an angry Michelle Obama was alleged to have used the slur. During Bill Clinton's earlier campaign for president, it was Hillary Clinton herself who had employed the super predator theory of conservative William Bennett, who cast inner-city children of that generation as almost completely unmoralized, and the font of a new generation of street criminals, the youngest, biggest, and baddest generation any society has ever known. The baddest generation did not become super predators. By 2016, they were voters who judged Hillary Clinton's newfound consciousness to be lacking. It's worth asking why the country has not been treated to a raft of sympathetic portraits of this forgotten young black electorate, forsaken by a Washington bought off by DeVos elites and special interests. They too toil in this new global economy. The employment rate for young black people, 20.6%, in July of 2016, was double that of young white people, 9.9%. And since the late 1970s, William Julius Wilson and other sociologists following in his wake have noted the disproportionate effect that the decline in hard-working manufacturing jobs has had on African-American communities. And if anyone should be angered by the devastation wreaked by the financial sector and a government that declined to prosecute the perpetrators, it is African-Americans. The housing crisis was one of the primary drivers in the past 20 years of the wealth gap between black families and their country. But the cultural condescension and economic anxiety of black people is not news. Toiling blacks are in their proper state. Toiling whites raise the specter of white slavery. Moreover, a narrative of long-neglected working-class black voters, ensured by globalization and financial crisis, forsaken by out-of-touch politicians, and rightfully suspicious of a return of Clintonism, does not serve to cleanse the conscience of white people for having elected Donald Trump. Long-suffering working-class whites do. And though much has been written about the distance between elites and real America, the existence of a trans-class, mutually dependent tribe of white people is evident. From Joe Biden, Vice President. They're all the people I grew up with, and they're not racist, they're not sexist. To Bernie Sanders, Senator and candidate for President. I come from the white working class, and I am deeply humiliated that the Democratic Party cannot talk to the people where I came from. To Nicholas Kristof, columnist for The New York Times. My hometown, Yamhill, Oregon, a farming community, is Trump country, and I have many friends who voted for Trump. I think they're profoundly wrong, but please don't dismiss them as hateful bigots. These claims of fidelity and origin are not merely elite defenses of an aggrieved class, but also a sweeping dismissal of the concerns of those who don't share kinship with white men. You can't eat equality, asserts Biden, a statement worthy of someone unthreatened by the loss of wages brought on by an unwanted pregnancy, a background check box at the bottom of a job application, or deportation of a breadwinner. Within a week of Sanders lambasting Democrats for not speaking to the people where he came from, he was making an example of a woman who dreamed of representing the people she came from. Confronted with a young woman who hoped to become the second Latina senator in American history, Sanders responded with a parody of the Clinton campaign. It is not good enough for someone to say, I'm a woman, vote for me. No, that's not good enough. One of the struggles that you're going to be seeing in the Democratic Party is whether we go beyond identity politics. The upshot? Attacking one specimen of identity politics after having invoked another was unfortunate. But other Sanders appearances proved more alarming. On MSNBC, Sanders attributed Trump's success in part to his willingness to not be politically correct. Sanders admitted that Trump had said some outrageous and painful things, but I think people are tired of the same old political rhetoric. Pressed on the definition of political correctness, Sanders gave an answer Trump would have doubtlessly approved of. What it means is you have a set of talking points, which have been poll-tested and focus-group-tested, Sanders explained. And that's what you say rather than what's really going on, and often what you are not allowed to say are things which offend very, very powerful people. This was a shocking definition of political correctness, proffered by a politician of the left. But it matched a broader defense of Trump voters.
Some people think that the people who voted for Trump are racists and sexists and homophobes and just deplorable folks, Sanders said later. I don't agree.
This is not exculpatory. Every Trump voter is most certainly not a white supremacist, just as every white person in the Jim Crow South was not a white supremacist. But every Trump voter felt it acceptable to hand the fate of the country over to one. One can, to some extent, understand politicians embracing a self-serving identity politics. Candidates for high office, like Sanders, have to cobble together a working coalition. The white working class is seen, understandably, as a large cache of potential votes. And capturing these votes, in the near term, necessitates the eliding of uncomfortable truths. But journalists have no such excuse. In the past year, Nicholas Kristof could be found repeatedly pleading with his fellow liberals not to dismiss his old comrades in the white working class as bigots, even when that bigotry is evidenced in his own reporting. A visit to Tulsa, Oklahoma, found the anthropological Kristof wondering why Trump voters support a president who threatens to cut the programs they depend upon. But the problem, according to Kristof's interviewees, isn't Trump's attack on benefits so much as an attack on their benefits. There's a lot of wasteful spending, so cut other places, a man tells Kristof. When Kristof pushes his subjects to identify what wasteful spending, a fascinating target is revealed. Obama phones, a fevered conspiracy theory that turned a long-standing government program into a scheme through which the former president gave away free cell phones to undeserving blacks. Kristof doesn't shift his analysis based on this comment, and continues on as though it were never said, aside from a one-sentence fact check tucked into parentheses. Observing a Trump supporter in the act of deploying racism does not much perturb Kristof. That is because his defenses of the innate goodness of Trump voters and of the innate goodness of the white working class are in fact defenses of neither. On the contrary, the white working class functions in the rhetoric and argument not as a real community of people, so much as a tool.